Valentine's response imitated a memory of his father.
My apologies, Valentine. I'm sure you want to know about the outfit you've been ordered to join. Zulu Company is one of 10 companies in the Arkansas Regiment, which makes up the smaller half of the Wolf Brigade. There's only 3,000 or so wolves in all of Southern Command, counting aspirants and reserves, and we're the most numerous of the hunters. We're in reserve now, but don't expect to spend a lot of time dancing at regimental balls. Maybe 2/3 of the regiment is together when we're wintering in the Wachitas. We don't often fight shoulder to shoulder. The last time was when we stopped a grog incursion out of St. Louis. That's when Poole bought it. Zulu Company has 4 platoons of about 30 men each, as of this month. 15 support personnel, mostly older wolves who aren't up to running 50 miles a day anymore. 7 wives and 2 husbands who can keep up with the camp. And 4 transport teams of 4 men, making me responsible for a little over 150 lives. I have 12 senior NCOs, but I'm short a lieutenant out of the 3 I should have. You want the job?
Valentine swallowed his mouthful of beer, which had turned into a grapefruit descending his throat.
Me? An officer? Sir, I'm not even 20 yet.
Napoleon was a lieutenant of artillery at 16, David.
And Alexander the Great was a king breaking up rebellions at 20, sir, but I'm not either. I've never read a book about tactics.
The captain set down his beer and crossed the room to the desk.
Valentine, I've got a folder here. In it is what we call your Q file. Don't ask me what the Q means, because I don't know. It's got your reports about what happened on that barge, and it's going to contain your report on the Mississippi crossing once the copy works its way here. There are some words from wolves like Pankow and Paul Samuels. I also knew your father, slightly. I was younger than you are now in those days, and I'd give my right nut to be half the man he was. I heard he was murdered when you were still a boy.
LaHave returned to the chair.
David, I know from people I trust that you've got brains and guts. You also take responsibility. Most people try to hide from it. You've shown some initiative in going after the enemy, and Everetti told me that you're smart about avoiding a fight, too, which takes a certain kind of courage.
Valentine listened to LaHave's summation of his record as a wolf, but LaHave didn't know about the fear and horror inside the Harpy barge that had unmanned him into lighting his bomb without thinking it through, or the stupid theatrics with a gun, a valuable pistol now submerged in the muddy river bottom thanks to his forgetting to hang on to it in the water, to get a cramped recruit on her feet, or the luck of a clear sunrise that saved them on the shores of the Mississippi.
And one more thing, David. Our very own wizard, Amu, recommended you to me. That counts for something. He reads people like a book. Don't misunderstand me, please. Being an officer is a tough tackle. You drink last, eat last, sleep last, and usually die first. No one notices your good decisions, and you have to bury your bad ones, and then write home to somebody's parents that their son stopped a bullet carrying out your orders. Getting them to fight is the least of your worries. The wolves know their business. But getting them ready for a fight, choosing where and when, and then getting them back safely takes a special kind of person.
Why did you become one, sir? An officer, I mean.
Long story, David. I wasn't even a sergeant, just a vet in charge of 4 kids younger than you. Our platoon went into the wrong town. Quislings had a hell of a fine ambush set up. They'd killed just about everyone, and what had been a friendly stop, and filled it up with their people. Somehow they scared a family we knew into greeting us and making everything seem normal. Everyone was tired and hungry, so we dispersed for dinner and sleep. And that's when they hit us. The lieutenant and sergeants got it first. It seemed like the lead was flying from every direction but up. I made it out and got some other survivors together. Dogs at our heels and reapers screaming from the hills. I've never been so scared, before or since. Been pretty damn close a few times, though. But we made it back. I carried a wounded wolf the whole way, but she didn't weigh much over 115. So they made me an officer. Funny thing to do for a guy who spent 3 solid days running from the enemy. But that was a good number of years back. The Free Territory changed from a backwater cluster of hard luck farms to a real patch of civilization. The Kurians haven't had any luck stomping us. We're not as big as some of the groups out east, even. I understand there's a band of hunters ranging the Green Mountains of New England up to Canada and down through the Smokies, about twice the size of us. And the freehold in the Pacific Northwest is more square miles. But out east, they're more of a wandering guerrilla army. They don't have a spot to really call home. And in the west, well, it's only a rough confederation out there. A couple of the strongmen playing lip service to the Constitution and Bill of Rights. A few even think the hunters and the life weavers are part of the same disease as the Kurians. You'd think the days of men fighting anything but the Kurians and their Quislings are over, but I'm sad to say it just isn't so.
The captain shook his head, eyes downcast.
Curse of Babel, I guess. We just can't work on the same team sometimes. But back to the here and now. Can I count on you, Valentine?
Has anyone ever counted on me? Valentine wondered. He thought of the gangly little girl, Jill, and her unknown mother. Can they count on me? Will I be able to prevent some black-fanged monster from making lifeless husks of them? He remembered the little pool girl's response to Lahav's request. Maybe Lahav liked to be answered that way.
Can do, sir.
Valentine hoped the enthusiasm did not sound too forced. The captain walked Valentine out into the pleasant afternoon. The worst of the summer's heat had faded, and the clouds were piling on and thickening overhead. Five-pole teepees filled what was probably once a lawn and putting green.
Zulu Company is spending time in reserve, Valentine. Your last winter, you stayed in true winter camp. Four companies get to do that, another four are in reserve, leaving just two companies to stay in the outlands. They'll be spread thin, patrolling and relying on the cats for notice of anything major outside the borders. But if something happens, or a good opportunity to hurt the hoods comes along, we go out of reserve. That doesn't mean we'll be sitting on our rears. As of today, you're acting Lieutenant Valentine, on my authority. The Colonel will confirm after your coursework gets done. We're not the guards. The civilian government doesn't have to give its rubber stamp. I'm not giving you a platoon yet, though you'll get your bars right away. But back to your duties. You're going to be in charge of the support staff, transport teams, and the aspirants. When you aren't doing that, you'll be running back and forth from the officers' training college, which holds classes at the old UA Pine Bluff campus on the west side of the lake. If you want my advice, you'll memorize Sun Tzu and study the 19th century campaigns of the Apaches and Comanches and some Civil War histories of Bedford Forrest and Stonewall Jackson. Just read enough about the rest to pass your tests. You'll learn a lot about how to fight when you're outnumbered and outgunned. When you're reading about the Chiricahua, try not to remember that they were on the losing side. It'll be a hell of a schedule for you. You'll be grateful for it. We got officers all over the place who are just jumped up sergeants, and though they're hell on wheels with the men, sometimes the lack of formal training leads to problems.
When's this gonna start, sir?
It started the minute you accepted your commission, Lieutenant. The War College is always more or less in session. One more thing. Everett, he said you get some kind of premonition that there were Reapers around. Answer me straight. Was it a lucky guess, or did you really catch wind of something?
Valentine thought for a moment before answering.
I can't account for it, sir. It wasn't based on anything I actually sensed, more of a by the pricking of my thumbs.
Something wicked this way comes. That's interesting. Reapers make horses and dogs nuts, too. Well, the nearest thing we have to a center for study of the Kurians, by us humans anyway, is at the college here in Pine Bluff. They'll be interested in your story. There's a half dozen people researching the new order. They like to come out and talk to us after we've seen them up close. They always want to know which Kurian sent which Reapers, as if we can tell. Let's get you quartered, and you can go meet them tomorrow when you enroll yourself at the OTC.
The following day, after a delicious cool night in a cot in the warmth of the junior officer's teepee, which he had to himself because his tent mate was on a training patrol, Valentine rode through the bustling little town to the college campus. It was an uninspiring collection of solid little 1950s buildings, dominated by a curious stunted tower. A clock that some tinkerer had restored to its function decorated it. Uniformed guards, sitting outside one brick building, revealed the location of the War College. As he had business there, Valentine decided to make the OTC his first destination. Exchanging friendly nods with the lounging guards outside, Valentine followed an old black-and-white plastic sign with a red arrow to the office. Valentine reached out to take the rag. when a chorus of shrieks sounded from down the hill in the direction of the old road. Valentine spun and ran to the wide loft door.
Ravies! Goddamn ravies!
The banshee wailing out of the midnight mists turned the back of Valentine's neck into a bristle brush. He bent to the gap in the floor.
They're here! Keep to your posts, look to your fronts. The rabies might be a ruse. They could be on top of the hill already.
He ran to the ladder and clambered down the rungs two at a time, driving a splinter into the flesh opposite his thumb in his haste. Valentine unsnapped the leather strap of his parang sheath and drew his revolver.
Uncle, the flares!
But Patel knew better than to wait for an order. The veteran sergeant already stood at the gaping southern door, lighting one. A wolf opened a lantern door so he could thrust it in. The high-pitched shrieking grew louder until it filled the night. The firework burst into flame, illuminating the barn with blue-white light and sharp black shadows. Patel wound up and threw the burning flare down the slope they had just traversed. Before it landed, he lit another and hurled it into the darkness as well. Other wolves copied him, tossing phosphorus candles in each direction. Valentine stared down the hill, transfixed by a mob emerging into the glare. Running figures with arms thrashing as if trying to swim through the air swept up toward the barn. Seemingly endless supplies of wind powered their screams. Their siren wail was paralyzing. They were human, or what amounted to human, considering their minds burned with madness, but with the wasted look of corpses and sparse streams of unkempt hair. Few wore more than tatters of clothing. Most ran naked, their skin pale in the light of burning phosphorus.
Don't let them in close enough to bite! Drop them, goddammit!
Rabies fell, one rising again with blood pouring from his neck to stagger a few paces and fall once more, this time for good. Another had a bullet tear through her shoulder, spinning her around like a puppet with tangled strings. She regained her balance and came on, screaming all the way. What looked like a scrawny 10-year-old boy stepped on one of the flaring candles without a glance. Valentine watched as the human wave approached, dribbling bodies as the wolf's bullets struck. He knew the rabies served as a distraction for something else lurking in the night. He felt the Reaper stalking his mind, approaching from the darkness, even if he could not see its body. The Reaper came, full of awful speed and power. A cloaked figure charged into the light, seeming to fly over the ground in a blur of motion.
On!
A wolf squeezed off a shot and worked the bolt on his rifle. The caped and cowled figure, still 20 feet from the barn, made a leap and crashed bodily through the old planks and beams as if they were paper mache. The Reaper landed on all fours, arms and legs splayed like a spider. Before a gun could be turned in its direction, it sprang at the nearest wolf, a shovel-bearded wedge of a man named Selby. It was upon him before he could bring up his gun. The hood's satchel-sized mouth opened to display pointed ebony teeth. Large, inhuman jaws sank into Selby's arm, thrown up in defense. The wolf's scream matched those from outside as the thing opened its mouth to bite again. Chaos reigned as the refugees began running. Wolves at the exits had to restrain them, taking up precious seconds when they should have been employing their guns. One wolf pumped shot after shot, working the lever-action rifle from his hip into the Reaper, pressing Selby to the detritus-covered floor. The Reaper fed, immune to the bullets hitting its heavy robes.
Selby!
Valentine grabbed a candle flare from Patel's two remaining at the south door. He thrust the candle into the lantern, waiting for it to sputter into life. It caught after an eternity, and he ran toward the hood. The thing raised its blood-smeared face from its twitching victim to receive the burning end in its eye. It slapped the candle out of Valentine's hand with the speed of a cougar's paw. As the thing rose, the Reaper's menacing black shadow filled the wall of the barn. Death reached for Valentine, who struggled to draw his blade from its sheath in time. A bullet caught the Reaper in the armpit, staggering it. A heavier, leather-clad missile hurled itself onto the hood's back. Patel's body blow brought it down, and using every ounce of his formidable strength, the sergeant managed to keep it on the floor until Valentine brought his machete onto the back of its neck. The blade bit deep into flesh and bone, but failed to sever the head. Oily, ink-black ichor poured from the wound. But still the thing rose, rolling Patel off with a heave. The sergeant fought on and bore down on one arm, ignoring the deadly teeth opening for him. Valentine lashed out again with his machete. The Reaper's head arced off to land next to Selby's lifeless body.
Jesus! They're in! They're in!
A few Ravies, ghoulishly white in the glare of the candle, clambered through the gap in the wall created by the decapitated Reaper. Valentine shifted his parang to his left hand and reached for his pistol.
No.
The empty holster turned the movement into comic mime as he realized he had dropped the gun while getting the candle. But other wolves drew their pistols, snapping off shots at the shrieking forms. A Ravy plunged in among the families. Valentine rushed to the corner to find the howling lunatic pinned against the wall by a man who'd had the presence of mind to grab an old pitchfork when the fight started. The Ravy had both hands on the haft of the weapon, trying to wrench the tines out of her belly when Valentine came in, swinging his parang to strike and strike and strike again until she sank lifeless to the floor, at long last silent. The screaming outside had ceased. The wolves opened ammunition pouches and took bullets from belts and bandoliers. A final bullet or two ended the spasms of the few crawling, crippled targets still living and therefore still dangerous. The men in the loft called downstairs in anxiety over their comrades. Valentine ignored the chatter and saw with a kind of weary grief that one of the wives had been bitten by the impaled Ravy. He went to check on Patel. The husky sergeant was on his feet, one arm hanging limp and useless, Valentine's pistol in his working hand. Patel handed the pistol back to the lieutenant. He held his hurt arm closer to his body and grimaced at the uncomprehending floorboards above.
Quiet up there! And keep your eyes peeled!
Broken collarbone, I think. Could be my shoulders out as well. Are you okay, sir?
Hell, Patel. Enough is enough. Next it'll be, I hope you liked your drink. Let's get that arm in a sling for a start.
Valentine motioned an idle wolf over to help his sergeant. He saw another of his men bandaging the Ravy bite on the woman as her anxious family crowded around.
We got a widower there who doesn't know it yet.
His sergeant nodded with sad understanding, and Valentine thought of Patel's family. They had been taken by the raving madness 5 years ago. The lieutenant walked through his shaken command, checking on his men, and came into the corner sheltering the escapees. He shot a significant glance at his wolf attending to the woman. The man caught the hint and nodded.
The bleeding stopped already, sir.
Valentine pointed at the lifeless Ravy.
Quick action, Mosley. Grab someone and get that out of here.
The candles outside were sputtering out. Valentine walked over to the ladder, intending to check with Gonzalez upstairs, when the floor suddenly tilted beneath his feet. From the ground, Valentine saw an albino white arm open a heavy trapdoor in an explosion of dirt, dried leaves, and twigs. The barn had a cellar. The Reaper got halfway out of the trapdoor as the bullets zipped over Valentine's head. His wolves, still keyed up from the fight, aimed their guns with lethal accuracy and pumped bullet after bullet into the yellow-eyed creature. Under the point-blank crossfire from five directions, the black-robed shape jerked wildly and fell back into the basement.
Grenades!
Three of his men gathered at the trapdoor, now shooting down with pistols. Striking matches or using the lanterns, two wolves lit fuses on the bombs and hurled them down the square hole. Valentine grabbed the trapdoor, flung it shut. The first explosion threw the door forever off its aged fastening, and the second boomed as smoke mushroomed from the square hole. A Reaper sprang from the gap like something a magician had conjured up from the smoke. Arms nothing but two tarry stumps, and head a bony mask of horror. Even with its face blown off, the Reaper was on its feet and running, seeming to favor them with a splayed-toothed grin. The guns rang out again, but the creature fled through the exit, knocking Patel aside like a bowling pin in the path of a cannonball as the sergeant attempted another body blow. A tattered and smoldering cape streaming out behind it as it ran, the Reaper disappeared into the darkness. Some of the children had hands over their ears, sobbing with fear. Valentine tried to shake the drunken sensation that had come over him, but it was no use. The acrid air of the barn was too thick to breathe. He staggered to the door jamb. An hour later, with the barn cleared of bodies, except for the unfortunate Selby, who lay in his poncho in the empty blackness of the blasted cellar, Gonzalez again shared his discovery with Valentine. His scout, after asking for permission to speak privately in the loft, presented him with a filthy strip of cloth. Valentine examined the excrement-stained yellow rag with tired eyes.
Uncle smells something, sir, you know? He told me to check the area where we heard the bloodhounds real careful after everyone pulled out. I found this in the bushes where the Red River people relieved themselves, sir.
Valentine read the semi-literate scrawl by lantern light.
N plus W. Barn. About 20 gun. Yours truly.
Betrayal. That explained a thing or two. But which one is yours truly? Valentine wondered. He remembered a couple of the farmhands had hurried to the bushes as they assembled for the flight to the barn. He hadn't thought anything of it at the time. The fear in the night had turned his own bowels to water as well. He gathered three wolves from downstairs and explained what he wanted to do when the sun came up. Mallow and his reserve platoon trotted up to the barn, just beating the sun. Valentine suppressed the urge to hug the panting lugger, who looked as tired as Valentine felt.
One in the basement, huh? You had some bad luck, rookie, but it could have been worse. Good thing the Currian pulling the strings wasn't good enough to work more than one at a time.
Mallow shook Valentine's hand, then offered the junior lieutenant a congratulatory swig of Busthead from a silver flask. Valentine tippled gratefully.
The Currian had a little help, sir. Someone was sending the hoods love notes. They knew we'd make for that barn. They brought up the Ravies and had everything ready.
Oh, Christ. Some clodhopper thought he'd be up for a brass ring, huh?
Seems like.
What a welcome to free territory. One of their own dangling from a tree. No, I'll let them handle it back at the fort.
I lost a wolf, sir. They want quick justice.
Valentine had hoped that they would settle for a formal trial later, but the looks on his details face when they told him why he wanted the farmers searched made him doubtful. Mallow's face clouded over.
They'll obey orders, Valentine, or they'll see some quick justice. Tell them that if you must.
Yes, sir.
Mallow stepped inside the barn. The sky to the east was pinkening, ending the longest night of Valentine's young life. He nodded to his waiting wolves, and they roused the sleepy farmers and began checking pockets and packs. They had barely begun when the guilty party revealed himself. A 16-year-old boy, the one whose mother had been bitten the previous night, bolted for the gaping south doors.
Gotcha!
Two of Mallow's wolves interposed and restrained him. Valentine found a charcoal pencil wrapped in more rags of cloth, as well as a small compass.
A kid, what do you know?
The boy broke down, alternating threats and curses in between sobs. His ashen-faced father held his distraught wife. She already trembled with the weakness of the first stage of the disease that would claim her life within two or three more days, when she would have to be shot like a rabid dog. Mallow and Patel ignored the grieving parents and questioned the boy in time-honored good cop, bad cop fashion.
Who put you up to this, boy? What did they promise you?
If it were up to this guy here, he'd snap your neck with his good arm.
I can't help you unless you talk to me.
Tell you what, you leave another note. Only write on it what we tell you, and you won't get hanged.
Can't promise anything else, but you won't hang.
The boy's fear exploded into anger.
You don't get it, do you? They're in charge, not you. They make the laws. They run the show. And when they get tired of you, you'll be emptied, and the grogs will have the leftovers. Them that don't want to die gotta go along with orders.
Valentine, sick with fatigue, stepped outside to watch the dawn. As the yellow-orange sun burned through the morning haze, he wondered what doom of fate had selected him to be born into such a cruel, ugly time.
The rumors we heard, stuff about government experiments, that the apocalypse was here and Satan walked the earth. People getting rounded up into camps like in the Nazi movies. Creatures from outer space. Turned out the truth was even weirder than the rumors, of course. Seems to me we were trying to make for this Mount Omega. There was talk that the Vice President was there with what was left of the government and the Joint Chiefs. Only problem with it was no one knew where Mount Omega was. And then we came across the Padre. The Padre was working for someone named Roe. Not that he'd given up on Holy Mother Church, of course. He said this Roe was very special and was advising us on how to fight these things. We weren't interested. He said Roe was holed up in a safe place with food, liquor, women. I can't remember what all he promised us. None of us were interested in that either. We'd been almost trapped and killed by those kind of promises before. The Quislings were already running us down. Then the Padre said that this Roe knew what was going on. That got us, especially your father. Some of the guys said that it was another trap, but I went with your dad, because he'd done a good job looking after me. It turned out this Roe was a life weaver. He looked like a doctor from TV, really distinguished and everything. I guess you know who the life weavers are, living with the Padre as you did. He gave us this speech about doors to other planets and vampires and vital auras and how the grogs were things cooked up in a lab. We didn't buy any of it. I remember some of the guys started singing, "Row, row, row your boat," sort of having fun with him. We thought he and the Padre were a couple of fucking nuts, you know? He said something to the Padre, and then I swear to Jesus, he turns into this big gold eagle with flames for wings. Circled over us like the Hindenburg going up. None of us knew whether to shit or shoot, I can tell you. Your dad told us to quiet down. And it turned back into a man again. Or the image of one. Believe me, after that we listened. He told us about a group of life weavers on a planet called Kerr. They'd learned from some touchstones the secret of how to live off vital auras. To beings with lifespans of thousands of years, the chance to have a lifespan of millions must have been temptation. Too much temptation. They violated the Life Weaver law, their moral code, and started absorbing aura. They were trying to become immortal in the interests of science, of progress. According to Roe, what they accomplished instead was to turn their world into a nightmare. They became what we call vampires, beings that are, to us, immortal. They do this through taking the lives of others. These rogue life weavers, the Kurians, became the mortal enemies of the rest of their race. The Kurians smashed Life Weaver society. They'd been transformed from researchers and scientists into something else. Cold, ruthless. They used their skills to destroy all opposition. Overwhelmed, all the Life Weavers could do was shut the portals to Kerr. I guess it was an attempt to keep the infection from spreading. But it was too late. A few Kurians had already escaped and were using the Inner World Tree to attack the whole Life Weaver Order. More doors were shut, but that only cut the Life Weavers off, stopping them from organizing an effective resistance. It was like a house full of people, each hiding from a pack of killers in separate locked rooms, instead of banding together to fight.
The sound of galloping hooves interrupted the story. A rider on one of the three horses in the group pulled up in the yard.
Sarge!
The rider walked his horse in a circle.
The lieutenant says there's a grog column out east of here, heading this way, mounted on legworms. 4 legworms, 20 grogs altogether. Not coming right for us, but definitely looking. You're supposed to gather everyone up and get to the Highway 41 bridge. If the lieutenant hasn't shown up by tomorrow, you're supposed to get everyone to Round Spring Cave.
Got it, Vault. Now ride on down to the river and get the kids in gear. Slowly. Don't scare them out of a year's life like you did me.
The courier moved his roan off at a more sedate pace.
Damn, but the grogs are far out from Omaha. Maybe someone saw us outside Des Moines. A lot of Quislings live in this area nowadays.
The sergeant gathered up the 6 wolves remaining at the camp and issued orders. He motioned Valentine over.
Sarge?
Samuels pulled at the beard sprouting on his chin.
Valentine, we're going to be marching tonight. We're going to stick to an old road because I want to get some miles south of the grogs. But that means I've got to have scouts and a rear guard. I'm short-handed, but with the lieutenant and his group out. That means you're getting what's called a battlefield promotion. I'm going to put you in charge of the ass end of the recruit column. Make sure everyone keeps up. It's going to be six kinds of dark tonight with these clouds, so that won't be easy. Lucky for us, we've been slacking all afternoon. Can you handle that?
Yes, Sergeant!
Valentine threw out his chest, but nervous sweat was running down his back. Already, a few recruits were returning to the area around the old barn, some with wet clothes plastered to their bodies. They broke camp. Usually, the shouts and curses of the wolves trying to get their green recruits to move faster came from simple habit, but this time, the words were in earnest. They moved off into the deepening night. Before, they had done night marches only when arcing around Des Moines. The Grogs out of eastern Nebraska patrolled this area. They could follow a trail in day or night by sight, by ear, or by smell. They moved at a forced march with Valentine bringing up the rear. They walked and walked fast for 50 minutes, then rested for 10. The sergeant kept up a punishing pace. Complaints started after the fourth rest. By the sixth, there was trouble. A recruit named Winslow couldn't get to her feet. Her face was contorted in pain.
Ugh, my legs, Val. They've cramped up.
More water, less hooch, Winslow. The Sarge warned you. Don't come crying to me.
The column began to move. Gabby Cho, who had been keeping Valentine company at the rear, looked at him wonderingly. Valentine waved her off.
Get going. We'll catch up.
Valentine began massaging Winslow's quadriceps and calves. He tried to stretch one leg. Insects chirped and buzzed all around in the night air.
Just leave me, Val. When it wears off, I'll jog and catch up.
Can't do it, Winslow.
He heard the three wolves of the rear guard approach. It was now or never.
Up, Winslow. If you can't walk, you can hobble. I'll help you.
Valentine reached out a hand, grabbed hers, and tried to pull her up.
That's an order. But I'm not going to carry you. You've got to move along the best you can.
The wolves, rifles out of sheaths, looked at Valentine with raised eyebrows. They thought the situation humorous. A cramp-stricken recruit and would-be non-com trying to get her up by issuing orders with a voice that kept cracking. Finner was one of the rear guard.
What's going on? You two picked a hell of a time to hold hands in the moonlight.
She wants us to leave her.
No, she doesn't.
Okay, Winslow.
Valentine drew his gun.
I've given you an order, and you're not obeying it. I'm not leaving you to get found and made to talk about us or where we're going.
The words sounded odd. Do people really talk like this?
So I guess I'll have to shoot you.
Oh, Val, you've got to be joking.
Valentine looked at Finner, who shrugged.
Oh, see, Finner? I can barely crawl.
Move it, Winslow!
Samuels met them at the rear of the column.
Christ, Sarge, you tried to kill me.
As Winslow finished telling her end of the story, she shot a wounded look at Valentine. The sergeant planted a boot in her scrawny behind, then slammed fist and palm together.
Keep up next time, Winslow. Valentine.
The two men waited while the file drew away.
Don't ever use your gun except as a last resort on the enemy. Not out of consideration to that non-hacker, because the Grogs can hear like bats. You get me?
Sorry, Sergeant. Only thing I could think of to get her moving. Her legs were cramped up, she said.
Next time, kick him in the ass. If that doesn't work, you come get me.
I thought you said I was responsible for keeping them moving, sir.
Sergeant Samuels considered this, then fell back on old reliable.
Shut up, smartass. I didn't give you permission to pull a gun on anyone. Get back in line. Keep them moving.
Finner, drawing nearer with the rear guard, had a few words with the sergeant. Samuels doubled the column, returning to the front.
Hey, Valentine.
Finner jogged up to him.
Don't worry about it. You tried to get her on her feet when most guys in your spot would have turned to us. Don't let the Sarge BS you about the gunshot. A single shot is tough to locate unless you're next to it. Plus, that thing doesn't make all that much noise. I told the Sarge that if I thought there was a problem, I wouldn't have let you do it.
What did he say?
He said I shouldn't think too much. It was dangerous for a guy like me. He added a few comments about my mother, too.
A cloud, shaped like a snail with an oversized shell on its back, began to cover the rising moon.
I think he'd take a bullet for you, though, Jess.
Damn straight.
The light of the burning towboat faded as it sank behind them, and the three started for home. Not knowing how well the harpies could see, hear, or smell, they stayed under the trees. Nothing dived at them or circled above. Later, they sang softly as they walked through the shadowed woods, like young athletes returning home from a successful match. Beneath the bare-boughed canopy, Valentine felt safe from any of the surviving harpies. But the trees made the Reaper's attack that much easier. It stepped from behind a tree, plucking the gun from Delvecchio's hands and sending it spinning into the night. With its other hand, it picked him up by his backpack, holding the giant young man at arm's length like a filled diaper. Valentine and Orin spun around, flicking the safeties on their rifles. The Reaper put the frantic Delvecchio between them like a shield.
Drop him!
No! Wait! No! Don't let him! Don't shoot!
You might as well shoot, foodlings! You'll all three be dead as soon as I take you!
Oh, God! Let me go! Val! Get it off me! Get it off me!
Valentine thought his heart was going to break out of his chest. It pounded so hard. His tongue felt dry, and his eyes seemed misted over. Only a burning sensation from the region of his kidneys prevented him from fainting dead away. He waved at Orin, motioning him to spread out. The Reaper couldn't hold Delvecchio in two directions at once. Orin, eyes fixed on the hypnotic yellow eyes of the pale black-clad figure before them, did not respond. Valentine stepped backwards, rifle at his shoulder. The thing turned its gaze to Valentine, bringing Orin out of his trance. Seeing Valentine stepping away, Orin turned and ran off into the night, discarding gun and pack.
Run! I'll catch you! Hide! I'll find you!
The Reaper again shifted its attention back to Valentine in a quick, lizard-like movement.
Shoot, and I'll pull your legs apart, one joint at a time, as easily as you'd yank off a fly's wings.
Valentine continued pacing backwards, lowering the gun barrel somewhat. He stepped behind a thick tree trunk, aiming his gun.
Useless!
The thing looked at Gil, the young man quivering in its grasp. It drew the thrashing figure close.
You got one thing right, foodling. I am a god.
The Reaper turned him around, pointed teeth tearing a hole in his neck and severing his windpipe.
Sorry, Gil. Hope you do the same for me.
The .45 shell found Delvecchio's backpack. The dynamite exploded in pinkish-orange light, throwing Valentine on his back with a warm, irresistible punch. Valentine's ears roared and his head filled with light as he plunged into unconsciousness. It was almost dinner time when the exhausted residents of Weening heard a shout from the guard tower. A moment's pause while the watchers in the tower employed an old telescopic sight. The residents gathered, the still smoldering barn behind them, to greet the strange apparition. Barefoot, pants in tatters, shirt reduced to a few ribbons, and pale with fatigue, David Valentine walked into Weening. He held his rifle in one hand and bulging backpack in the other. He examined the crowd, looking for a face.
Mr. Helm.
He reached into his backpack.
We killed the thing that got your son. And Gab. And Gil. Steve, I don't know about.
Valentine pulled out a skull covered in sticky soot from the fire he'd used to burn off the flesh and hair. In everything but color, it resembled a human skull, with an oversized forehead and an unusually long jawbone. The charred bone was bluish-black and looked as if it had been carved from a block of onyx. Randall Helm refused the offering and instead put his arms around the weary 18-year-old and walked him home. That evening, Bourne opened a jug of homemade whiskey, and he, Valentine, and Helm took turns solemnly chiseling the names Gilman Delvecchio, Gabriella Cho, and Dorian Helm into the polished obsidian skull of the Reaper, still a little warm from its hours in the boiling pot. By the time the jug was recorked, the skull was mounted, slightly askew and off-center due to alcohol-impaired judgment, over the main gate of the village. It stands there still. Wachita Mountains, February of the 41st year of the Kurian Order. The snow is retreating up the rugged, rocky hills of the Wachitas, but an Arkansas winter still sits firmly in the saddle. In the narrow valley between two low mountain ranges, pointing like cleft fingers at the blasted ruins of Little Rock, a little collection of cabins mark the temporary home of Fort Candela. It is a fort in name only. The soldiers are scattered across 12 square miles of the valley floor. There is electricity most of the time, and fresh food some of the time, but warmth and companionship by the cabin hearths always. The erratic war is blessedly far from the men and women quartered in this valley. They concentrate on making and repairing equipment, cutting and sewing new uniforms, eating, drinking, gambling, and trading. And most important, training. This winter, like every other for the past 20-odd years, recruits get paired up with seasoned veterans until the green soldiers can do what the vets do and know what the vets know. Specialists and artisans travel through, giving lessons and once in a while taking on permanent apprentices if a recruit shows unusual ability at veterinary work, perhaps, or in making quality leather goods. The officers in charge of Fort Candela make decisions and act on them. One recruit has hopelessly bad vision, another drinks too much, and another cannot keep up on practice marches. The culls are offered support jobs, honorable service in paid labor outfits, or are returned to civilian life. Those who do not try for home are absorbed by the labor-hungry farms and towns of the Ozark Free Territory, but a few malcontents become bummers and inevitably a matter for the law. For the rest, the question becomes guards or hunters. 7 out of 10 often go to the guards, the military regiments that provide a defensive corps for the Ozark Free Territory. Guard service is rewarding. The soldiers get the finest uniforms Southern Command can produce, ample ammunition for marksmanship training, and frequent parties and barbecues, games, and riding contests. Many of them are mounted, adding to their dash and swagger. They also get plenty of opportunities to mix with civilians. No New Year's dance is complete without a handsome contingent of young guards in polished boots and crisp charcoal gray uniforms, kepis with regimental colored neckerchiefs hanging to precisely the base of their tunic collars. The guards are the well-ordered, well-disciplined, reassuring face of Southern Command, who can and do fight, giving their lives in defense of wives, children, and sweethearts. The others, the men and women who will become cold-eyed hunters ranging outside the friendly reaches of the Ozark Free Territory to slay the minions and quislings of the Kurians, are brought before the Life Weavers. A glossy black house cat named Sailor Tom ruled the cabin with an iron paw. 6 men shared the bunkhouse nestled in a hollow between 2 spurs of Fourchet Mountain, but none disputed the feline's claim to the warmest chair by the stone fireplace or the best tidbit from the steer quarter hung in the cool room. The heavy cat looked like a witch's familiar with a lynx somewhere in the family tree. He strutted around the cabin on muscular rear legs, half wild and all attitude. Sailor Tom asserted his authority with a rising corkscrew growl that blossomed into a biting, clawing fury aimed at anyone foolish enough to ignore that first and only warning. He gained his nickname when one wolf declared, "If that Tom spoke English, you'd just know he'd be cussing like a sailor." The men tolerated the bad-tempered cat and pointed him out to recruits as an example of tenacity to be imitated. The men depended on stored food to get them through the winter, and Sailor Tom exterminated trespassing mice, rats, squirrels, and even rabbits with samurai spirit. The cat's realm encompassed a two-room sooty kingdom full of beds and furniture as roughly finished as the men who occupied them. A fireplace of watercourse stones dominated one entire wall at the sitting part of the bunkhouse, and a 200-years-old and still-going-strong pot-bellied stove warmed the sleeping part, a musky warren of bunk beds and old blankets hung for gloomy privacy. Four veteran wolves and two recruits shared the cabin. Pankow, Gavino, Big Seth, and Imai saw to it that neither David Valentine nor Marquez, the other wolf aspirant, enjoyed a moment's peace. Anytime they were not actually in the field or attending a lesson as part of their caste training, the four senior wolves dedicated themselves to seeing that the would-be hunters idled as little as possible. Not just with training. Marquez found himself held responsible for the firewood supply and general cabin maintenance. The firewood might seem an easy task for a man in the middle of a forest, but the wolves insisted that Marquez fell and consequently hauled the timber from 2 miles away. If he so much as looked at one of the bushy pines surrounding the cabin, the trainers accused him of wanting to expose their temporary home to the enemy. The wolves assigned everything else to Valentine. Everything else included cooking, washing up, laundry, stocking the pantry, mending, disposing of Sailor Tom's half-eaten Corpus Rodentia, and the morning ersatz coffee. The men accepted a certain amount of slackness and inefficiency in all his responsibilities, excepting the last. No matter that Valentine may have returned from a night orientation march, exhausted at the first pink of dawn, if the coffee was not steaming and ready to be poured at the customary rising hour of 6 a.m., he was thoroughly cursed and punished. This required a fell run up Bald Knob, a 40-degree grade hill bare of trees, under the disapproving eyes of the four coffeeless wolves. Valentine learned from all four, but his principal mentor was Evan Pankow, the child of a representative from Ohio. The then 7-year-old congressman's son had watched his privileged world disappear in a few insane weeks when the raving madness virus swept the United States. Young Evan was one of the few people immune to the virus. While this protected him from a death that claimed better than 3/4 of the United States population, his genes were useless against the war and chaos that followed. He followed a stream of refugees into the tidewater of Virginia, where he got his first taste of the Kurian Order. He witnessed an albino man with yellowish eyes and a soft voice claiming to be a crisis governor kill an entire family in a hotel room. The boy, forever after avoiding the Reapers, was flown southwest by a woman who had also witnessed the crisis governor in action. Pankow had lost his parents, and she had lost a son, leading the two to form an increasingly real mother-son bond. The pilot's name was Jamie Costas, a former journalist who wrote some of the first pamphlets examining the Kurian Order. Her early writings, accurate in fact, but mistaken in analysis, brought her to the attention of the Life Weavers. Through her, Evan became a student of the Life Weavers and a wolf. In his 20s, Pankow helped found Southern Command. Now 50, with a seamed face and world-weary eyes that reminded Valentine of a portrait of Ernest Hemingway he had seen in one of the Padre's books, Pankow devoted himself to training a new generation of wolves to carry on the struggle. One late February afternoon, with snow camouflaging the mud surrounding the little cabin, Pankow lectured his aspirant about, of all things, tea.
It's way too easy when you're outdoors and on the move to just eat rabbits and such.
Pankow ran his ungloved hand across the soft needles of a mountain spruce.
Especially in cold weather. You get hungry for meat and fat and you forget about everything else. But you gotta get your greens. You know what vitamins are?
Yes, sir, I do. It's those letters, A, B, and C, and so on.
Yeah, well, when I was a squirt, we got them in stuff like breakfast cereal, little candy pills. Damn near everything said vitamin fortified. Now, it's not so easy, it being winter. You take these spruce needles. In the spring, the little buds taste pretty good. You can just chew them. But if we pull some of these needles and boil them up into tea, you get as much vitamin C as from an orange, even. Have you ever had an orange?
Valentine shook his head.
Too bad. Sweet and juicy like a watermelon, but tart, too. Anyway, your greens aren't a problem in summer. Any fool can pull up a dandelion, chew its leaves, and roast the root. But winter, that's a different story. You don't get your vitamins. You end up losing teeth, getting fevers. You'll catch some virus and die even if the scurvy doesn't take you. Trappers in Canada used to die of it. Rabbit fever, it was called. They were starving their bodies to death while stuffing themselves with fresh meat every night. So never just eat meat on the trail or at home. Add a lot of greens if you value your eyesight and your teeth.
We should just raid more food off the Koreans.
That's not so easy. But before you can fight, you have to be healthy in mind and body. I know it seems hard what we've been having you do, but soon your body's gonna be like a whole new machine. We're trying to get you as strong as possible so nothing quits on you once you start keeping the way of the wolf.
When will that be?
Well, that's not for me to say. Not for you to say, not for the captain to say. It's up to the old wizard. He might be watching you now. He might be advising the governor in Mountain Home. One thing is for sure. No one who meets him comes away the same as he was before.
The Reaper thrashed around in pain, and Valentine stuck his foot onto its chest to hold it in place. The smell sickened him. He felt thankful for his empty stomach.
Some bitch is moving around too much. Let's finish him. But I want to look him in the eyes for a second.
Ever-Ready cut the cords around the thing's neck with the sharp edge at the tip of Valentine's parang. The Reaper's face was a mess. Two gummed-over bullet holes in the cheek and forehead stood out against the deathly pale skin. Black fangs snarled at them from above the butchered neck. Its eyes were not the pink of a true albino's, but rather black, with slit pupils and yellowish reptilian irises. The creature glared hatefully at the five humans around it. Valentine felt hard pressure against his foot as it tried to wiggle loose despite its injuries. Valentine looked into its eyes and felt lost in the black depths. Was there such a thing as blacker than black? He felt himself compelled to lift his foot off the thing's chest.
Steady there, David. You look like you might keel over.
The voice seemed to come from somewhere near the Gulf Coast. Valentine tried to raise his eyes from the black slits. Failed. Don't give in to the darkness, a part of his consciousness urged.
It's only the black eyes of the crow picking at your father's brains.
Valentine raised his eyes up to the lightening sky and planted his foot even more firmly on the mutilated torso.
That's better, David. You gotta watch those eyes. For a second there, you looked like a bird staring at a snake. You weren't seeing the hood. It was the Kurian behind it.
Ever-Ready leaned over its face, taking a small cylinder from his pocket with his left hand. It was a crusty old battery of a type invented just before 2022 that had a very prolonged shelf life. A symbol of a black cat leaping through an electric hoop could be seen on the casing.
Here I am again, Hungry Prince. Old Ever-Ready got another of your drones, you murdering pig. I know it feels good when your little bloodsucker here takes a life.
Ever-Ready waved the battery label as close to the snarling face as he dared.
How do you like it when I do this?
The body quit moving under Valentine's foot. A fresh wave of moldy crypt odor wafted from the corpse of the Reaper. Burton promptly emptied the remains of last night's dinner from his stomach. Alistair sank to his knees, trying not to join him. Ever-Ready thrust the parang into the dirt and picked up the head, cautiously draining the black syrup from the neck. Holding it by the scraggly black hair, he displayed the trophy up for the wolves to get a good look.
See how the teeth are black? We call that stuff carbonite. It's not a scientific name or anything. I think it's out of a movie. Stronger than steel. And Kerr builds the hoods so they use the stuff for their skeletons, teeth, and nails. Stops bullets pretty good. I saw one take a face full of double-aught from about 2 feet one time. The eye and the nose holes are baffled, not open like in a human skull. So the son of a bitch was just blinded, and maybe couldn't smell too good either. But it kept coming for us. And while I left this bastard's fingers behind, they have these pointed black carbonite fingernails that can claw through a safe door, peeling it back layer by layer.
The cat wedged the old battery into the Reaper's mouth and stuck the head in the crotch of a nearby tree. Its eyes rolled around in their sockets.
It's dead. Don't let that unsettle you. Just nerve impulses or something.
Returning to the body, Everready continued the autopsy. He began to peel back layers of skin with parang and skinning knife, sticking small broken branches through the skin to keep the wounds open. The black tar had stopped flowing with the creature's death, but an abundance of oily, clear liquid seeped out of the cadaver. Alistair was still on his knees and looked about to go to all fours, and Hernandez was wiping his mouth with the back of his hand. None of them would eat that day, Valentine suspected.
Okay. A whole bunch of a human being is taken up by equipment to process different kinds of foods into our blood. These monsters don't need all that. They have as simple a digestive system as can be. But they have this big bladder inside. See that thing that looks kind of like a honeycomb?
He opened up the sponge-like organ, bigger than a bovine liver.
Those little sacs fill up with blood like a camel's hump and pass through this thing, which is kind of like a placenta to its bloodstream. And see those two thick cables going down its sides? Those are nerve trunks. It's got more than one. Yours goes up the backbone. If that gets snapped, you're dead. You can break its back, and maybe it'll just walk funny. It's because it's got these other nerve trunks, all wired to a couple of balancing organs in the head. Gives them ungodly reflexes and agility. Little clusters of nerve cells at pressure points help that. Their spines are much more flexible than yours, like a cat's. And the knees are hinged so they can bend backward, coiling just about every major muscle in their bodies for a jump. Everything's heavier than ours. Bone, skin, muscle makes them crappy swimmers. They can move through water, but they really have to thrash so you can hear them coming with all the splashing. I keep telling the jokers in the free territory to dig wide moats around everything they build. Something they can't jump over, but they don't want to make the effort. If you ask me, if 100 Kurians got organized, they could go through Southern Command like a bullet through a paper target.
Valentine raised his hand. Since Everready was showing this unsuspected schoolmarm side, it seemed the appropriate thing to do.
Why don't they?
Overrun us, you mean? One of the things we don't know. We do know that each Kurian boss or prince or master or whatever has grown his 13 Reapers to feed him and run his show. We think it hurts them when one of their puppets gets killed. There's some kind of special link that allows the vital auras absorber of the Reapers to feed the Kurian that controls them. Over the years, the stories about the Kur got confused. That's if our ancestors ever had them right to begin with. We combine the two creatures, the Reaper and its master, into one vampire legend. But that's got nothing to do with nothing, as my old man used to say. The masters don't like to have all their Reapers together in one spot. We think if all of them buy it, so does the Kurian. Those Kurians are selfish pricks, too. They don't risk their hoods helping out other Kurians. You see it in the different ways their little principalities are organized. Maybe they even fight among themselves like mafia gangs, if you know what those were. We can only hope. They're not too creative. They don't seem to invent anything. The Life Weavers have got a philosophical answer to that. They say the Kurians have degenerated over the millennia, becoming like addicts who can't see beyond the next fix. Nothing matters to them but keeping the vital auras flowing. Even when they invaded, they laid the groundwork well. But once it started, it was like the Oklahoma land rush. They all grabbed a spot and started harvesting, well, us. But all that is for the thinkers and the strategists and the leaders. You boys have got to be the killers. So just remember this one thing. The only damage that puts a hood permanently out of commission is a central nervous system disconnect. That means severing the head or blowing it to bits. And since they duck faster than most folks can swing, let alone pull a trigger, it ain't easy. You got to get them when they're dopey, after they've fed or in good daylight. You get them out in the sun without their robes, they get so sick you can slice them up easy as pie. Sometimes they get laid up in a trance, either daytime or nighttime, and that's a good time to hit them too. My theory is that a Kurian lord can't really control more than one reaper at the same time, and the others either go on pure instinct, feeding off whatever's around until they're gorged and pass out, or they fall into this trance while the Kuriali is controlling a different hood.
Sir, you said there would be others on this one's trail. Are we gonna jump them?
A small smile broke out across Everready's ebony features.
Son, you got more balls than brains. You ain't even blooded wolves yet. For the last time, save the Sir stuff for the ones that have to hear it to believe in themselves. I'm here to teach you how to keep hid so the Reapers don't find you. Finding a Reaper's a job for a team of wolves. Yes, sir, about 10-1 odds is what you need. And that's 10 well-armed, experienced wolves. Even I don't take on an up-and-running Reaper if I can avoid it. I got all these teeth by being patient.
Everready fingered the rope of polished fangs across his hairy chest.
You need to hit the enemy when he ain't looking for you, not when he is. A stand-up fight is work for the bears, and even they die faster than the life weavers can replace them sometimes. Nope, it's been a fun summer. But I'm gonna get you all back across the St. Francis alive and well. Hopefully, a little bit wiser, too. School's just about out, boys.
Getting to the St. Francis meant they first had to cross the Mississippi. Wide, muddy, and sandbar choked at this time of year, the Father of Waters was no easy obstacle to overcome. Quisling traders and river patrols